Hi, this is Captain Jean-Luc Picard. No, sorry, this is Gates McFadden, who played Dr. Crusher from Star Trek TNG. And you, my friends, my good dear friends, are rocking out and listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for April 25th, 2023. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
Just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. This week, Chip, you can find a portal to another world and escape all of the traps of this world.
Well, some people would say that's wishful thinking. Other people get hunted by direwolves, Steve.
Yes. Some people just love Star Trek.
It's the whales, Steve. It's the whales.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Guess what, Chip? I went to a movie theater and saw a movie this week, a movie that was on my calendar for the last 3 months.
Steve, when you announce that, you should ask people to sit down. They may not believe it.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. No, I went to go see Evil Dead Rise in theaters. It just opened this week, and it is the latest in the Evil Dead franchise.
So this is part of, how many Evil Dead movies are there?
It depends on how you count, my friend. Depends on how you count. There are three different series of films. The Ash movies with Bruce Campbell as the lead. There are three of those. Then there was a remake that I did not see because it was a horror movie. Then there was Ash versus Evil Dead, the TV series. This is a whole new story, a whole new group of people who are trying to get away from the flesh-possessing demons that are the Deadites.
All right. Is this a cabin in the woods?
No. This is a high-rise apartment in the middle of the city. A very, very different setting instead of that cabin in the woods where the monsters are in the dark and you never know what's going to happen. These are a group of people trapped on the 14th floor and they can't escape the evil that is the Deadites. These sort of like zombies. They're kind of zombies, but they're more demon than zombie, and they're coming for you, and they can't be stopped no matter what you do.
That sounds awesome, Steve. How is this different than the previous franchises?
The original Evil Dead movie was a couple of friends, Sam Raimi, his brother Ted, and Bruce Campbell going out and having fun and making this very gross Evil Dead horror film. Second film is kind of retreading that same story, but with a much more comedic bent, very much in the style of the Three Stooges. It's like the Three Stooges on a horror movie. The third movie, The Army of Darkness, is possibly my favorite, possibly everybody's favorite. We've discussed that one lots of times. That one is very campy, very silly. We get behind the characters and we want them to succeed. This one is not that same campiness. This one is very much a 2023 horror film, but it does have that same soul of ridiculous gore from the Evil Dead series. The buckets of blood are very much in effect in this one.
Buckets of blood, Steve. That sounds like a band.
Dane Michael probably has a band, Buckets of Blood. It's mostly practical effects too, so there's something special about the filmmaking. I was completely riveted by the story, these people who are in the situation, and by the filmmaking. How did they make that visual happen? There's puppetry involved. There's so many different practical effects that I was riveted by this.
Well, I'm glad you went. I'm glad you had a good time. And do you have any other movies that you want to see that have this same appeal?
Boy, oh boy. I don't know that I'm going to become a horror movie fan from this film. This is definitely a horror movie. I don't enjoy horror movies in general, but I love the storytelling of The Evil Dead because of the campiness. This one has so much potential. The potential of what's going to happen in this individual story. We don't even know who the hero is in this story until the very, very end of this movie. There's well-written character development. I really know who these people are, this family that is in peril in this story. The one thing that bothers me, though, is that there's kids in peril here. There's some very, very young people who are in grave danger in this story. The one who really stands out is the youngest one. Her character name is Cassie. She's played by a very young New Zealander called Nell Fisher, and she is strong beyond her years. I see huge potential for what she is going to bring to the Evil Dead franchise going forward.
Okay. That sounds awesome.
That was probably some spoilers to say that she is one of the characters that makes it through this adventure. That's pretty spoilery. Interesting fact is this is a film from New Zealand and Ireland. Those are the two countries that came together to make this movie. It gives it a very, very different feel from standard Hollywood. There's a lot of different ways that the expression of thought is different from a New Zealand and Ireland. The writer and director is Lee Cronin. He's from Dublin, so there's a definite difference in his viewpoint. And the actors are from New Zealand. I look forward to seeing what they have in store for a sequel here.
Now, we've discussed this in the past, but you know, Hollywood films have a flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a way that they present information. And a lot of our curiosity as humans is to find foreign films that have, they have a different way of looking at the world.
Agreed.
It's very good to challenge yourself to take part in something else.
This is not exactly a foreign film in that sense. It is certainly trying to fit into that Hollywood zeitgeist, but it definitely has that little bit of flavor, a little bit of spice that makes this different. And it's got Chekhov's chainsaw. I just love.
Does it have a Russian accent?
No, that's a different Chekhov. We'll get to that in a moment. This Chekhov, he is famous for hanging a gun in the first act, and then that gun has to come into play at the end of the story. That's what happens in this story with a chainsaw. There just happens to be a chainsaw that is very clearly marked and presented in the beginning of this movie, and I was one of the ones in the theater who went, oh, the chainsaw at the beginning, and then boy, oh boy, did it come into play at the end. The buckets of blood, it's so ridiculous. This movie is so ridiculous with the amount of Karo syrup and fake blood that is just spewing upon these actors, including a very beautiful homage to The Shining, where a elevator full of blood arrives, and it's glorious. I don't know how they did it, but it looks beautiful. I recommend this movie to everybody who's an Evil Dead fan. It's different from Bruce Campbell, but it's still got that same soul to it. I also got to get through the finale of season 3 of Picard on Paramount Plus. Talk about nostalgia. This is deeply nostalgic. Season 3 brings back all of the original cast from Star Trek The Next Generation and puts them in peril, oldly going where everyone has gone before. They are a bunch of old people and having this adventure and saving the universe.
Sounds awesome, Steve. You sold it to me.
You have no interest in Star Trek. I understand that. This was, I was so prepared for the finale of the story at the end. Of course, I'm sobbing. I'm crying at the storytelling because I love these characters so much. I have enjoyed their adventures for, you know, decades. At the end of the story, I turned to my wife and I said, we should quit our jobs and go be people instead. That is one of the messages that we learned from this so nostalgic, so campy Star Trek that brings us home in so many beautiful ways. You would hate
that. That sounds very interesting because it certainly be the. I'm sorry. It certainly represents that generation. Mm-hmm. And as you look at, I don't know, maybe many of the representatives of the federal government and leadership. Maybe they should follow Jean-Luc Picard's, request. It's maybe a good time to retire and go be people.
Make it so. Yes, I agree that that is one of the many messages that is being expressed in Star Trek Picard. I know it's campy. I know it's silly. And you know me, I love campy, silly things. And I ate this up along with many of our listeners who have posted their thoughts about Star Trek Picard and knowing full well that it's sappy. It's a fun adventure with some people that you know these characters, you love these characters. You saw a movie called Linoleum. Tell us all about this one.
Are you familiar with it at all, Steve?
I don't remember talking about this at all. So, no.
This stars Jim Gaffigan.
Okay.
And this is actually about if this was made, I don't know, 10 years ago, it certainly would have been a different actor playing this. This is very Robin Williams type of film.
Oh, okay.
And this is also a film where it's kind of a puzzle. You're being asked to kind of figure it out. So as the trailer kind of shows, all of a sudden a Corvette drops on the ground in front of us with a person who falls out of it that looks just like Jim Gaffigan's character. And then you've got to kind of figure it out. He is a husband and wife that have gone through life. It seems like everything that they are working on didn't quite work the way they wanted to. They started out as scientists. They started out as people who wanted to be, the question is, are you an astronaut or an astronomer? Are you an observer? Are you the person of adventure? And they kind of asked that question. Now, there are people and strange things that happen throughout the story. And eventually they come together and you get to see what the puzzle is. It is kind of, this is not for everybody. It certainly was well reviewed and well received as a thinking person's type of film. Once again, in the vein of a Robin Williams type of story. But this is Jim Gaffigan. And I would say 65 out of 100. It is esoteric. It is kind of out there. It's not necessarily always clear about what you're viewing, but certainly a very thoughtful film. And certainly the writer and director, who I think are the same person, did a very unique story. We look for uniqueness in our movies. This would fall under that. If you get the opportunity to see it and you're up for a thinking person's movie, this would be one to consider.
Very, very intriguing. I am definitely going to look that one up. That sounds like something that is right up my alley, and probably some of our listeners would be in the same camp of wanting to go through something esoteric and interesting. And a little bit, is there a little bit about aging in there too? Did I hear a little bit?
Of course there is. Uh-huh. Of course there is. There's the youthful idea of what can be, the adventure part of you. You've got the part where life goes on. He is ultimately, as a scientist, this husband and wife team, they eventually decide they're going to do a children's science show. They do it out of their garage. They've got enough of a budget, but it doesn't really get the time slot they want. It never really happens the way they want it to. It's not working. but it was that activity of doing and then kind of transcending that and going through life. Well, the question you have to ask is all time existing at the same time? And there's your little circle. There's your little bit, maybe too much information.
Oh boy, I love it. All right, I am definitely going to look that one up.
Book it. Brings us to our book it, our book of the week, our great, wonderful, fantastic end of the month book club, where we get to rotate through and find the book that we want to talk about. And Pam Bedore comes in to tell us how much she knows and how much we don't. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Steve. That is 100% not how I think of talking to you guys. It's so great to see you both. How's it going?
I'm looking forward to being learned.
That's the goal. The real goal of the book club is for Pam to come in and I have my notes about a book and she has her amazing questions and she gets us to the next level of thinking.
Well, this isn't a book that I would have picked up on my own. So thank you, Steve, for bringing it to us.
So with that introduction, you understand that this was my month to choose a book. So we all know what we're in for, ladies and gentlemen. Sit back, relax, and enjoy our discussion of Outland by Dennis E. Taylor. We've read Dennis E. Taylor's Bobiverse book, the first book, We Are Legion, before, and I love Dennis E. Taylor's writing. He's writing for a certain demographic, a certain Gen X male demographic that happens to be a teacher and understand a little bit about science, just enough to be dangerous.
This is such a Gen X book. I completely agree with you.
Oh, yeah.
This one is about a super volcano in Yellowstone that erupts just about the same time as six university students and their experimental physics project find an alternate universe where they escape and bring as many people as they can to rescue. And there are so many different references to pop culture and so many jokes about how Gen X thinks. I really enjoy this book and I hope that you did too.
Yeah, I really liked the book a lot, Steve. And I really liked We Are Legion, We Are Bob. I think that the title should always be listed with the parenthetical We Are Bob. So this was a lot of fun. It maybe doesn't score super high on the realism scale. I mean, there were some elements that were a little silly, including putting all of those Gen X references in the mouths of kids born in 2020, in 2000, sorry, or 2001. And so I'm sorry about, like, when one of the kids is like, wait a minute, you haven't seen City Slickers? I'm like, literally no one born after 2000 has even heard of City Slickers.
You've never even heard of Billy Crystal. Are you kidding me?
Exactly. Even though their names are Bill and Kevin, which literally I've never seen a student named Bill or Kevin in that age range.
They said it was totally rad.
Yes, yeah, Dennis E. Taylor certainly writes in the voice of his thinking, that Gen X voice, and I eat it up.
It's awesome.
Chip, what did you think about this book? First impression.
Well, John Hammond spared no expense. Now, I did look it up. He wrote this. This was one of his original novels, and he actually went it through an editor to rewrite it, and it shows up that way. And what I mean by that is there's a lot there, but a lot of it wasn't even resolved. I mean, when the velociraptors, I mean, the direwolves show up, you know, all of a sudden we've got this story that, you know, they work as a team, but we never get to see the team in play and the bad guys getting eaten.
This was a self-published book in 2015. He then got the contract to write the Bobiverse series in 2016. That was that the first book was published in 2016. He pulled this one off the shelves, had it, ran it through an editor, and then republished it through Audible in 2019. And then a sequel, Earthside, was published in 2022. A definitely different writer 7 years later.
Oh, interesting. So have you read the sequel? I didn't even realize it was a book one until I finished the book. And then I started looking around and I was like, oh, I didn't know it was a book one. So yeah. Is the sequel, would you recommend it?
I would recommend it because it is Dennis E. Taylor. It is okay. Written for me. This author gets me and understands what I need in life is more Homer Simpson references.
Actually, were there a lot of Simpsons references?
Not as many in this one as in the Bobiverse.
Yeah, not I think that's right. Either. Exactly, yes.
But lots of references to Jurassic Park. That's why I thought Chip would like this one. This is an action-adventure, just go-go-go kind of story, which I believe is the kind of story that Chip likes, right?
Well, Crichton's book, Jurassic Park, is an exploration of dinosaurs. There's a lot of like backstories of what the latest science is on dinosaurs. There's nothing like that here. Mm-hmm. This is just a, let's introduce some stuff and go with it. And I mean, it's not like they're sitting down and you're going through a, I guess we got a little bit of what the theory of multiple universes would be, mm-hmm. But certainly not Crichton level.
This is not hard science for sure. This is definitely not The Martian. This is not doing the math. This is just the adventure.
Well, Jurassic Park, I wouldn't say is hard science either, but it certainly, there was a lot more effort put into using whatever is known at the time.
But do you think that he did do that work to some degree regarding volcanoes? Because I hear what you're saying, Chip. I didn't think he did the work on multiple universes at all, but I actually thought he did do the research on volcanoes and on volcanic ash and on the sort of, you know, nuclear winter follows, like the idea of a volcano as a civilization ending event and how that would play out.
It certainly would be. And, you know, and it's a very real threat if it ever happens.
And that's what I kind of liked about it is you guys know that I am a big fan of apocalyptic literature, and we have these sort of repeating apocalyptic scenarios, right? Several of them come out of the climate crisis, but then you have the meteor, you have the unfriendly aliens, you have nuclear war, you have zombies, there's all these things. And I'm not sure I've read a volcano apocalypse before.
Huh.
Like, I can't think of one. I should have looked it up, but
other than volcanic movies, I don't know that I've read a book where there's a volcano. I think you are absolutely right. That's why I chose this one for you, Pam, because it is an apocalyptic. So between the Jurassic Park references for Chip and the apocalyptic structure for you, I thought for sure you two would love this book.
But
if only we had Pompeii to kind of work as an example.
Yes, he does mention Pompeii. That is a part of this conversation for sure.
He does. And I feel like there are many books about a volcano that's not civilization ending, right? It's just a volcano that actually is civilization ending is the one I haven't seen before. But in this case, there's an escape valve.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel like I've just thought about that a lot as I was listening to this book. Excellent audio, terrific narrator.
Ray Porter, my favorite audiobook narrator of all time. Exactly. I love what he's able to do.
Yes, yes. So excellent narrator. But I do think that you have this apocalyptic scenario. This could end certainly life as we know it, and perhaps, you know, human life and perhaps, you know, higher mammal life on Earth forever, but you build in an escape valve, right? And so then you don't have to deal with it. And I'm like, I really have tried to think through the politics of that because, of course, you know, the reason that apocalyptic fiction is super, super popular right now, is that we live in a bit of a choose your apocalypse moment, right?
I look forward to that book series.
You say that, but I mean, in the grand scheme, most of us are not living through World War II type situations.
Right. But World War II, do you feel like people thought this is going to end human civilization?
No, people were just dying, getting their arm blown off or whatever.
Right.
World War I, the American Civil War, whatever place you go back to, the things right now are much more esoteric. I mean,
100%.
You're not being thrown into crisis situation and then your goal is to survive it. Right. You're kind of, I don't know, you're sitting in your air-conditioned house with, the limited amount of media we have available. I mean, come on. suffering through, do you order pizza tonight or, make something fresh? That type of thing.
The only thing on is City Slickers 2, Curly's Gold.
No, but in the cultural imagination, but this is what I'm saying, that like in the cultural imagination, there are a number of different, existential threats that people worry about. And I feel like the three that my students talk the most about in these classes, climate crisis, obviously, there's many, many, elements that follow out of that. People are worried about nuclear war again, which we as Gen Xers were very worried about when we were children. And
listen,
now,
I know that we're supposed to go underneath our desk.
Right, exactly.
Because that will save us.
All good. But then the third one is AI, mm-hmm. right? And so, these are actual things that people worry about. So we don't spend a lot of time, or at least I don't, and maybe you guys don't either, spend a lot of time worrying about volcanoes.
Right. Volcanoes are pretty low on my priority.
In the Choose Your Apocalypse, scenario, that's a lower one, but it's interesting. But then it's like, what's the escape valve, right? And a lot of times when you think certainly about climate crisis, there are many, 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 many novels where the escape valve is space,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's the final frontier.
Exactly. But then the multiverse actually ends up acting as a different version of escape to somewhere else.
What if we could start over where we're still, we're the hunted?
Exactly.
And I think of the metaverse as a possible place to escape as well. If we get to the singularity, if we get to the point where the Bobaverse kicks in and we are able to download our consciousness into a machine, then, the Matrix saves us because we're all safe. No problem. We are safe. Get it?
Or it's hell. You remember Paprika, which is the Battlestar Galactica series, the spinoff, where the Cylons, basically their humanity was stripped from them. Mm-hmm. The brain was there, but the humanity was stripped from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cylon.
Right, and that is arguably an existential threat. Mm-hmm. So even though something continues, it's not what we would call human civilization.
And that's what we get here is they continue something. They have something. And what's interesting to me is how Dennis E. Taylor writes about the need for structure in that civilization, finding a way to get all of the things that they need to survive in a wilderness, in a different world where they don't have the modern conveniences.
We're kind of talking about later on in the book. We haven't really outlined what the story is.
And I think, so there's two very, very different halves. The two halves are very, very different. And so one thing that I found was very interesting, and this isn't really meant as a critique, although maybe it's a little bit. He has these six university students, right? And so he's got the four boys, the two girls. And I'm calling them boys and girls quite deliberately instead of men and women, which is what I call my own university students. But they seem very, very young, and they all are pretty much the same. They talk exactly the same way. Ray Porter did a great job of like doing voices for everyone. But the reality is all their sentences are structured identically. It's very hard to keep them straight in your mind. It's Kevin's the Midwest, the British man. Genius. Other than that, they all sound pretty much the same. So.
It's the Midwest.
Okay.
That's how we all sound, Pam.
But the University of Nebraska Lincoln, my goodness, what a class of students. These like teenager, 20-year-old kids, they have absolutely comprehensive knowledge of their areas of expertise, which as a university professor at a fine school with many excellent students who works a lot in the PhD program and the honors program, wow, these kids are amazing. Amazing.
they spent a lot of time recruiting those. Go Cornhuskers.
The University of Nebraska at Lincoln is the place to be, is all I'm saying. Like, wow.
And obviously there's a simplicity to the writing here where he needed a zoologist, he needed a mineralogist, he needed a climatologist, and he rates all of those characters where they need to be.
And by the way, that was described the University of Nebraska too, because it is a big Midwestern school, but almost all their big programs would be at that university. It's the ag school, mm-hmm. the science school, and all the other
engineering
stuff.
Engineering school.
Yeah, I mean.
But I love that these teenagers are like, you know what? We need to set up a power plant. Let's get 2 engineering undergrads and we can totally make that happen. Like, it was awesome.
I'll take these 2 pieces of this MacGyver right there.
Yes. You know? Yes. And they miss, one person doesn't know the MacGyver reference, but no one under 20 knows the MacGyver reference.
MacGruber.
They know MacGruber. That would be the reference to the reference. Yes.
That was very, very funny.
And then we get Monica, who is the gun-toting law enforcement aspect of this. She is, in my opinion, the main character in a lot of ways. I find myself thinking about who she is more than the title characters, the main characters, because you're right, they are very flat characters. She is the only one that's given any kind of agency to be kind of like the Bruce Campbell character here.
Yes, that is such a good comparison. Absolutely. Yes.
I love how he puts this team together. We have a little bit of science, just enough science to make it almost believable, but it's just a fun adventure of a ride here.
And one thing that, to me, the place where the science got away from him the most, but which was very good narratively, right, was how it was very convenient that you're in this alternate dimension, but if you set up your satellite dish just right, you can totally get news from Earth. I was like, you didn't even have to give up you didn't even have to give up on the internet, man. You just set it up in the alternate universe and point it in just the right direction.
Right in space.
And thankfully, even though all of the US is no longer transmitting, you can get satellite coverage from overseas in the other dimension.
It's a
I'm going to back that up. I'm going to challenge that. The thing that was most realistic about it is you have this, I don't know, new dimension you're going to go through, and they immediately go, you know, we got to pay for school. They're out panning for gold. And, you know, they're bringing back, I don't know, just, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they've got to figure out some way to, you know, that's the initial part was we're gonna pay for college, and then we got to figure out some way to get this gold to that's not suspicious.
Yeah.
And oh, doggone it, the IRS is gonna come. We didn't pay taxes. You know, all this other stuff, and you know, immediately they start ordering Amazon because they're going to expand the operations as long as nobody finds out about it. But the bad guys do.
Oh, we get to Schrodinger's gangsters. Are they dead or are they alive gangsters that they push
Schroeder.
Through?
Remember? Schroeder's gangsters. Schroeder.
That's a pianist.
I was thinking of Ricky Schroeder.
No, the joke in the book was, no, he played the Schroeder played the piano. Schrodinger had a cat. Yes, and apparently indeed. Some gangsters.
Indeed. Oh, but I actually liked, so Chip, I'm going to push back and say, I actually liked that they were so goofy, right? They were so immature at first, and that they were really worried about how to pay for college. Like, that's what kids are worried about today. To me, that was realism for what 20-year-olds today are thinking about. They're thinking, how am I going to pay for college? And they're also thinking of fame. Like, did you notice that immediately? These are like two kids in a Midwestern college make a discovery. They're like, this isn't, we're going to get the Nobel Prize for this. How do we make sure we get the Nobel Prize for this? Right. And then when they actually look at how much the Nobel Prize is financially, they're like, oh, it's not really as much as it sounded like. Also realistic. And then they're super worried about college. And then once the volcano hits, I think that's a common trope of apocalyptic fiction, is that some people still are like, well, wait, we have to get the money. And someone else is like, guys, money doesn't matter in this new world. And that is a very recognizable apocalyptic trope that he did really well, because you're right. After spending so much time panning for gold and with, you know, trying to figure out how to turn gold into cash, they realize, oh, that economy does not exist anymore.
And
they did,
and that's where I brought up the news article that was this week, the $200,000 in dimes that was stolen. Because it's the same problem. What do you do? You're going to go to the grocery store and buy your groceries with dimes?
How many can I get with this much? Yeah, just I can't imagine how they're going to get rid of all of those millions of dimes.
Yeah, see, we got to figure out a way to get these dimes. We can't deposit them in a bank. You know, all of a sudden you're showing up everywhere and you're paying for your meals and dimes. He pays cash for everything.
And you know, it's dimes. Every time.
How do you get rid of dimes? I'm going to Disney World. I'm going to pay for it with dimes. It doesn't work. And that's like showing up with handfuls, bucketfuls of gold. I got all this gold. I got to somehow work it through the economy.
Mm-hmm. Money laundering. You got to go to Ozark. That's where you got to go.
And when the bad guys are like, yeah, we're just going to take half of it. And the other half, I'm sure they would have been fine with it, because they didn't know they were going to be able to kind of work it through the economy. The deal was, is that lack of information, you know, the deal maker kind of put them off. They didn't realize they could have worked with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Pam, you're in the middle of reading Fairy Tale by Stephen King, which has a very similar piece where there is gold that needs to be laundered.
I only started it this morning. I'm only like 15 pages in, so
can't wait to hear how much you like it, and also how much it's Stephen King, and the ending is terrible.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Wow. A really, like, not very pleasant spoiler. Like,
oh, come on. You're telling me that you didn't know that a Stephen King book would be a terrible ending? That's a trope in and of itself.
Come on. They vary. Endings vary. Actually, that was one of my exam questions. I shouldn't say this on the air, but that was an exam question that I may well use again in my Stephen King class. Was Stephen King is often accused of terrible endings. Agree or disagree, using three novels from this class. And interesting, well, you said it. Interestingly, many students actually argued that his endings are good, and they could find novels from our class to support that.
Monty Python sketches had great endings too. And Saturday Night Live sketches.
Now, one other thing that I thought was like unrealistic in a way, that the satellite I thought was hilarious and great. You know what? Get the news. I love it. Now,
BBC, by the way.
It's a BBC narrative way to get the story, right? It's easy.
Totally fine.
America's gone, by the way.
Yes. And only some parts of Western Canada survived. I'm like, wouldn't it be like Newfoundland? But anyway, whatever. Western Canada, it's all good. But one thing that I sort of paused on, and I don't know how you do this, but in this scenario, you have about 300 people, 300, you know, 20-year-olds who are now in the alternate dimension. And someone mentions it, the kid who's going to become like the head of neurosurgery. She mentions it once, but like, how depressed would these people be? Like, they've just lost everyone they know, except for these 300, you know, fellow college kids. You know, they miss their mom, they miss their dad, they miss their brother, their sister, their pet. They miss the internet, they miss their way of life. Mm-hmm. They're not just like, okay, like, I believe that the six originals, whatever, the original gangsters, what were they called? The great owners, the, what were they called? The G.O., the gate owners. The gate owners. So I actually believe.
Of Rivendell.
Exactly. I believe that those six kids who are all geniuses, like world-class geniuses who found each other, like those six kids are like, woohoo! Like, they don't have close ties. Like, I believe that. But like these other 294 kids, you know, they're like so depressed that I don't think they're just going to jump into a venison chili eating world and be fine. Like, it was
lots of venison, lots of buffalo,
you know,
and your chili doesn't really have a lot of spice.
So there was some, like, I understand narratively why he did that, but I also felt like the idea is so cool and you could have done a little bit more emotionally. But Steve, this was written for you, not me. Isn't, so you were so like, I don't want to hear about sad people. Is that
right? I'm gonna add a little more to that, because I do think having the University of Nebraska is actually a good thing.
100% agree. Yes.
And my feeling is, it's, you know, Nebraska is a farming community. A lot of people working on equipment. You know, it's when I say very Midwest, there's these small town values with a lot of people who have probably multiple skills and multiple varied backgrounds.
Yes. Yes.
In addition, using college students is really a great idea too, because what do you get? You get a young, healthy population who is smart, who can learn things, and the idea is they're going to repopulate a world. I do think that where you kind of missed was, listen, you got a number of hours. This is the Midwest. It does snow. Why does everybody go back to their dorm rooms, grab their boots, grab their coats, grab, you know, their blankets and whatever they need to?
They grab a book or two. They don't bring any. They have all this information in their brains. And guys, our kids today, they haven't memorized anything. We haven't asked them to memorize anything in 20 years. So
I know how college students dress. How many of those women who went across were in flip-flops and like a t-shirt or whatever it is? And you know, like, we're going over to a world where, you know, having your shoes covered and all that other stuff would be important. And I'm going to expand this a little bit, because we're over at a university, which is a great place to pick people. But it could have been easily, they could have set up another one over at Walmart and said, okay, the pharmacy's coming with us. All that camping equipment's coming with us. All those, you know, whatever we can throw through there, we'll just create big piles of stuff. And we'll have, we'll have rotting food or whatever. But we need seeds. We need all these things that to help us get started. But he kind of blew through that. You know,
you
that Walgreens...
You think that wasn't a big part of the story, where they're going back Earthside to get all of those supplies?
Those salvage operations. That's what that was.
I think that's a huge part of the story.
Anyway, I would have been at the beginning of it.
So in Pam's question about whether or not this is my kind of story with my kind of people, the answer is yes.
Yes, I know that.
I think of our friend Dane Michael, who is at a university, who thinks about these things this way. And yes, the characters are very flat, but they have the tools that they need and they think through. You're right. Books would be important because they don't have access to the internet the same way. So they need to find information through written word, which would be a difference. But Denise Taylor writes about lonely people who don't have those connections. That part that bothered you, where these kids would be depressed, would be mourning all of the loss in their lives. Denise Taylor doesn't seem to think that way. When you think of back to the Bobiverse, that was a big part of the story of the Bobiverse, was this Bob was the loner. He was the one that had no attachment to other people, and that's why he survived.
And that's what I'm saying. The six main characters, the gate owners, totally make sense. But I feel like they don't understand that those 294 other kids are going to be like seriously depressed.
And I would argue Dennisy Taylor doesn't think of that.
I'm going to suggest that that may be true, but they will quickly be working on adrenaline because they are the hunted. I mean, it is not like they went to a world and it's like they didn't have lots to do. You're so busy trying to, I don't know, create protection and stuff like that. I'm not sure if you have enough time to be depressed. I don't think people in wartime situations are moping. They're in crisis mode at that time. And so over time, yeah, there's going to be some stuff. And, you know, imagine you're not on caffeine or you're not on whatever pills you're taking at the time or whatever like that.
They did talk a lot about coffee.
There's a lot of conversation about coffee in this conversation, for sure.
But you guys, and then there was also our two stoner characters who felt like they felt a little more real than others. And then they just got murdered and nobody minded. I missed our stoner characters.
They were slackers, man.
I felt like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure references could have been a little bit more prominent.
Okay.
That's basically what happened to Bill and Ted, right?
They didn't bring a lot of guitars around, man.
They would have gotten the books. The other class of people that is not in this story that Dennisy Taylor does not give us is the athletes, the frat boys. Where is that clique in this story?
They were the ones who tried to take over. They were the ones who were like, we're going to rule this land, but our GOs were ready for that.
Is that the way you read that? That's who those people were? Yeah,
they're like the elite. They're like the, you know, they're the kids who've always had everything and who assume they'll be the leaders of the next generation. And they're like, wait, why are these science kids the leaders? We're the business kids. We're the frat boys.
Okay.
But maybe I read that.
I'm sure you're probably right. I just read them as bossy
politicians in training.
There you go.
Right? I mean, I think. But no, what do you think, Chip?
There's 250 kids. So, you know, and once again, it's the Midwest. I'm sure that there's people with ambitions and all that other stuff, but you know, you probably got as homogeneous population as you can imagine there. So, I mean, I you know, there could be challenges, but I think that if you were going to pick an area, it's not like there's that much difference.
At least we get the really smart kid. We get Kevin, who is like the stereotypical nerd. The gangsters identify him as the weak point in this chain because he looks the part. He's got that meek attitude.
And he's Indian, right? So he's also, it feels like a very white group of kids. Yes. The Indian kid with the British.
Welcome to Nebraska.
I know. Thank Kevin. Now, one thing that Kevin says that I think is really interesting, and I think it's quite true, although you guys are more sciencey than I am, is he says, you know, we can't really hold on this because whenever you make a new discovery, someone else is right behind you. Like there's a cultural zeitgeist and a scientific zeitgeist where multiple people will get to that same like big game-changing idea at the same time. And I think that's a real thing in science, right?
Absolutely. There's, you know, the radio is invented and, you know, another across the pond, another radio is invented at the same time. Airplanes are invented and another person has invented an airplane. You know, those type of things end up happening.
And that's what I keep thinking about with AI. Rob Reed wrote in After On that the first group to make a reasonable AI is going to be the most powerful because everybody else is going to be trailing behind forever because of the exponential growth.
Those people at Yahoo absolutely agree with you, Steve.
Yeah, we are in a race for AI right now. The people who are building it.
I'm so sorry, Steve. Those people at Google are going to challenge that idea that the people at Yahoo being were the innovators.
Well, right now, Microsoft is the leader with what they're doing. And it's a race. It is a power struggle for sure. Just like the race to Mars, right?
Yeah, well, and this made me think of the SpaceX news from this week, too. This idea of, like, there's all of these different ways to do the same science, mm-hmm. right? So you can have this, you know, this giant rocket and be like, hey, if it blows up, it blows up. We just want to see if we can get thrust on such a large item. Or you can be like way, way, way more careful and slower. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It feels very like one thing that I really liked about this novel is that the different sort of epistemological frames, the different ways we think about how we do science, how we learn things. And also like the kids at the beginning were dealing with like, you know, a really unsupportive academic advisor, right? No, they're undergrads. And so, you know, that was a little bit more.
They haven't been to a modern university. That's so 80s. That's so 80s. There's like an advisor for every student.
So Elon Musk is definitely one of the characters in here doing the science and doing it in fast and loose, spending the money with that Starship that exploded this week. I'm sorry, didn't explode, had a rapid unscheduled disassembly.
That was my favorite phrase of the week. 100% favorite phrase from the
that's very very speak.
Yeah. And very pop culture. This is very much the way Denise Taylor writes these kids. Is let's try it. We have no choice. We're going in an emergency situation. Let's just do it. And they're successful eventually.
And then of course there's also the trope of they're gonna have a baby boom, right? Mm. So suddenly we've got all of these pregnant girls. Very predictably, you know, 6 or 8 weeks.
How did that happen?
When
you bring over 250, students,
grads,
bring the condoms. They forgot their boots.
I'm wondering if the 250 was enough. Do we have enough diversity in the gene pool right there to build from? I don't know.
I don't think 250 is enough diversity in the gene pool, especially because of the genetic makeup of those 250 and Kevin.
Right. Exactly. But there's probably someone else with an interdimensional gate somewhere else in the world. Mm. There's a lot.
Oh, is that a second book?
I'm just saying.
So there is a second book. It's called Earthside. It was published in 2022. And Pam, the literature professor that she is identifying what could happen in that story. And yes, there is more diversity to be had in the second book where they do bring over quite a few other people. The political viewpoint is those people have a different idea about leadership and a different idea about how things should be done and whether or not these 20 somethings should be in charge. Aha.
I love it. Yes. I think that sounds like a
bunch of French speaking people.
French gate.
Does Ray Porter narrate it? He's so good with accents.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Ray Porter is definitely the narrator for the second book as well. And I do recommend it highly. The ending of this one certainly lends itself to a sequel, huh?
Well, yeah. And of course, at the very end, they bring over the National Guard. And so you know that they're already open. By doing that, the kids are saying, like, we are open to having, you know, grown-ups who are used to being in a position of power join our colony. Although I'm not sure if they've really thought it through completely. Mm-hmm. Also, their geology professor appears. Hip, hip, hooray.
Because they didn't have enough geologists. They needed that speciality to be brought back.
Well, I mean, seriously, was it Aaron, the geologist man, I wish I had kids like that. I mean, I have amazing students.
And they brought over star running back, yeah, John Smith.
Exactly. They don't have the comprehensive knowledge that it's taken me 50 years to get anywhere close to. These 20-year-olds. This 20-year-old has, like, comprehensive knowledge of volcanoes.
I did like the idea of bringing over the National Guard. That's actually very good.
It's going to be very interesting, right?
This idea of having weapons available, having people who know how to do things, having a group know how to work in a team. Well, it certainly could be dangerous. At some point, though, it could provide some structure that allows those 250 people to survive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you truly are out in the middle of nowhere.
And you have to protect your stoners. Like, that was not okay. I'm still so sad that those two nice boys.
That's the part you focused on.
Those very relaxed, chill guys.
Beavis and Butthead.
Who had a good vibe about them.
Cool. They were murdered without causing a ripple to the society. Come on.
There was a drum line that was going to happen later on.
Oh, Ted.
Oh, come on. They had an intense pharmaceutical knowledge that could have become very important later on if somebody gets gets scratched by something.
You guys, you're not gonna have that modern medicine you just stole from the Walmart. Like, that's not gonna last forever, right? You're gonna need these medicinal items.
Exactly.
I sound like someone who has ever tried marijuana.
They go in some cave.
You
know, what they didn't have was Aaron Rodgers with, like, you know, to go in a cave for like a couple weeks, live in the darkness.
That cave, man.
Come back with some deep thoughts for us later on.
Thoughts.
Wow. I feel like we really did some good work on this, you guys. I think we really got to the bottom of this.
Once again, you can show this book club when Steve's book comes up and we just have fun being silly with his literature. I love the silliness of this literature. Yeah. I love the fun adventure of it.
Pam, he used the word literature.
It is. This is literature, but this is, you're right. This is early days for this author.
Is that an actual snort? Good Lord.
Yes, Chip cracks himself up.
Snort. So I would be super fine with reading book two at some point with you guys. I'd be happy to do that if you're in for it. Maybe not next month. I have a really interesting book for you next month. But in the future, I'd be happy to come back to this.
I do recommend the second book. It is not as much fun of an adventure as the first book. This is fun. This is loose and going and having an adventure. The second book is much more civilization building, and I'm not there for that nearly as much.
But I am.
I know. There's a lot of meetings in the second book, Pam. You would love it.
Yeah. All right, we got to break up into committees and a lot of committees
in the second book.
The first book too. I do like a good committee meeting. You guys all know that.
Yes,
I like live for agendas and minutes and good solid committee meetings with a strong sense of documentation.
Yep. Lit majors, no sense of adventure.
Well, hopefully they brought over an attorney. They got Robert's Rules of Order ready for that next.
I second that.
Can we now bring that to a vote?
I think we have to refer it to committee, but all right.
I love this book club so much. We have such different perspectives on all this stuff, and we come together and find a way to do it. Kind of like the people in this book.
Well, maybe the dire wolves will actually have some resolution, Steve. They showed up. They're bigger than normal wolves. They work as a pack.
And they get through the portal and get back to Earth, too. Aha!
But you know what?
Jurassic Park.
That was totally Jurassic Park.
It's totally Jurassic Park right
there. And then killed by a random farmer.
And at that point, just abandon the thread. Why even come back to that?
It's over. Don't worry about it. The volcano took care of them. Don't worry about it. I'm glad that you sort of like this, Chip. I'm glad that you went through this with us. I think the Babaverse is the book that I would suggest for people that are interested in reading Dennis E. Taylor writing for Gen X male teachers of a certain age. But this one is fun as well.
Totally agree. Thank you for bringing this one. This was fun.
Thank you for being a part of our book club. That is Outland by Dennis E. Taylor, published in 2015.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. There's plenty of things happening in the world. Let's talk about almost none of them. One of the things we've talked about so many times is AI. We talked about that with Pam Bedour during our book talk. What's going on with AI?
Well, OpenAI came out, I don't know, a year ago or so, and you have the ability to sign up and get access to it. That's the bigger one. Other companies have created their own AI system. Google's is Bard.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, received early access to Bard. I got my email saying I could go on. In fact, I sent Steve a script that was written by Bard that kind of describes our show, describing too much scrolling. Somehow it says that we review video games, Steve. I know your love for video games.
It also says that we're entertaining. So the AI is not infallible.
That's right. It is not. But it is interesting. I would encourage you, if you have access to OpenAI or to Bard, Google's Bard, mm-hmm. just to ask some questions and see what it kind of puts together. Because it will help you organize some thoughts,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because it is kind of self-learning a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's not perfect. I know that some professors have written about OpenAI, and one of the Brian Kaplan actually wrote about it early on. When I say early on, a few months ago. And said, oh, it would have received a D on this exam that I placed through it. He goes, but he redid it, and it actually would, I think it would have received a B.
Okay.
So it actually is improving.
Quick, exponentially.
That's right. You never know, Steve. We'll be plugged into the Matrix before you know it. And you'll be, I don't know, dodging bullets as they slow down in front of you. You'll be just like Neo, Steve.
The question becomes the ethical piece of this, and you found an article talking about how Google may have used some unethical practices here.
Exactly. So anytime you have you remember Google's original motto was don't be evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Not because Google's evil, it's because that is not their mantra. You're young, you create a company, you want to change the world, and you unleash it into the world, and Google did. I mean, as a search engine, it was pretty amazing. But since that time, they want to become profitable, and that means that you get to watch you get to skip two or three 15-second ads as you're trying to get to the video they're trying to watch on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how lovely for us. But deep down, Google's a company, and they have shareholders, and they are willing to grant lots of fun things to you, Google's Bard to you, but they also are willing to shut things down immediately if they decide it's not in the, you know, it's a whim, you know, whatever. This thing that you've spent so much time mastering, well, it's no longer available to you. Well, we get fun things like Google Map and all that other stuff, but what they're basically saying, or at least somebody is saying, who was working for Google, is that they're questioning maybe some of the ethical reasons that they're created this AI. And only time can tell. Only time will tell ultimately how this will play out. We hope that there's good intentions involved, but you never know.
Unintended consequences, good intentions might not be enough sometimes.
So think about what Elon Musk did to the Ukraine. He was it the Starlink that went over Ukraine and provided internet. Think about how powerful that is to be in a wartime situation where your infrastructure is being blown up. But because there is Starlink available, the maps are still there. You know how to get where you need to go. You know, you still have the ability to communicate with the outside world. Mm-hmm. Things of that nature are very, very powerful. Well, you know, that is benevolent. But at the same time, Musk said, hey, listen, this is somebody's got to pay for this. And he's asking someone to eventually do that. Well, isn't that what businesses do? They're solving information or challenges, but at the same time, they'd like to be paid for it. Well, Google gives, like Microsoft gives, like Apple gives. A lot of people give, but they want something in return, and usually it's a way to monetize it.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to think about the future of AI and the future of all of these companies and space exploration, and how we have gone from the government to these enterprising individuals, and how we're going to pay for that is intriguing to watch for sure. I journeyed back in time this week, Chip, and had coffee with Doug and Emmy Jo. You probably have no idea who Doug and Emmy Jo are. They were the creators and stars of a TV show called The New Zoo Review, which premiered in 1972 and stayed on the air for 5 years. It was a children's program with a frog and a hippo and an owl teaching little kids about the basic principles of getting along with each other, respecting the community and yourself, and doing the right thing. And boy, oh boy, is my lifestyle based on some of those lessons that I got from Doug and Emmy Jo.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I know the New Zoo Review, Steve.
You remember that?
I do.
The theme song goes through my head all the time. And seeing Doug and Emmy Jo, who are married, were married in the early 70s and are still married today, they are just adorable, absolutely beautiful people who are sharing their lives with us through Facebook. It's wonderful to be able to see who we are and who they are through this medium, and to experience life as we are, and to see the nostalgia and the possibilities for the future.
Well, that's interesting that they were married. I had no idea, but it makes a lot of sense. And certainly it was, the 70s were a very weird time for,
very weird.
You got Sid and Marty Krofft's strange time. You had McDonald Land with, talking hamburger flowers. Certainly uniqueness.
And that's what we learned on Saturday with Coffee with Doug and Emmy Jo, is that Sid and Marty Krofft were the ones who designed the costumes for the New Zoo Review. So
that doesn't surprise me.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all to find that out, but it's something to think about that they still have those costumes. One of the costumes was featured this week, and just the joy of big, huge puppets and being able to express for children the things that we want to tell them and get them to learn through song and dance. News Review is on my list of my big influences.
Next up, Ruth Buzzy and Jim Neighbors.
And Weird Al Yankovic.
Steve, you had a fun week. You got to be a featured performer on a Weird Al show.
Yes, our friend Lauren invited me to be on the Beard Al podcast this week to talk about the In 3D album, Weird Al's 1984, not debut, but the album that most people think of when they think of the Eat It guy, because Eat It was on the In 3D album. We talked about some of our real joy in listening to the music of Weird Al and the experiences that we've had with the community of people that love that ridiculous novelty song style.
And if you'd like to listen to it, you can find a link to it in our show notes.
That's right. Let's get to sports talk, Chip. Time to talk about football.
Well, we got a little streaming stuff we want to run through real quick.
Yeah, the NFL Sunday Ticket is moving to YouTube TV. They revealed their pricing this week. Sunday Ticket will cost you $349 a year on YouTube TV. If you want to add their Red Zone feature, that's $40 more for a total of $389 a year. If you subscribe to YouTube TV, then you can take $100 off of that Sunday Ticket. Are you interested in some football, Chip?
I don't pay for Sunday Ticket. For those who don't know what Sunday Ticket is, it means you have access to all the games except for your local market, which you go through your local affiliate.
Mm-hmm.
No, so if you're a person who wants to follow the Denver Broncos or the Cleveland Browns or some team that's not in your market, or want to follow, you know, all the teams because you like football so much, then there you go.
Yep, this is the way to do it. This is my Denver Broncos fan who lives in my home. I spend money to get him this broadcast every year. No word yet on student pricing. In the previous DirecTV plan, there was a student pricing tier, which was $100 a year, one quarter of the regular price. And I look forward to seeing if they will bring that over to YouTube TV as well.
And why this is important to follow is the NFL particularly, but sports is really the only television that is making money, like really making money. So especially the NFL. Mm-hmm. And so Google and YouTube, Alphabet, however you want to describe it, they paid a lot for this, the ability to do this. Mm-hmm. The NFL saw the opportunity to use this on streaming platforms and all sorts of other things that you can basically stream YouTube TV on.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to the transition to see how this goes from DirecTV, which only a limited number of people had access to, only the people with that satellite dish on their home, to a more open streaming situation.
So I'm going to bring up Apple TV Plus, which is Apple's streaming service. Now, they have had no problem spending lots of money on streaming shows, on movies, and animation. So they've spent a lot of money on that. They've recently created a situation where they have the ability for Major League Soccer to become the format that if you wanted to watch Major League Soccer and you wanted to stream it from whatever device you want to, $99, you could get Major League Soccer. Now that has failed to grab the number of subscribers that they wanted it to. But they have on the plate another opportunity, what they're trying to, and that's to get involved in a college conference. So college, basically football, basketball, baseball, whatever you wanted to. The conference that was really having a difficult time finding the dollar amount to compete with the basically two big conferences right now, the Big Ten and the SEC, is the Pac-12. And I'll tell you what ended up happening is that Southern California and UCLA joined the Big Ten. They're in Los Angeles. The Big Ten is, you know, from Nebraska all the way to New Jersey, you know, with Northwestern and Illinois as part of this conference, Michigan, Ohio State. They've created a nationwide conference. And UCLA and Southern Cal joined the Big Ten. Boy, we're getting in the weeds here, because they were going to make, I don't know, $50, $60 million a year. Pac-12 is not going to get anywhere near that. Mm-hmm. So now they're looking for exposure. Apple TV wants to be known as a sports provider too, once again, because it's the only thing that's bringing in revenue. So the Pac-12 started their own network. They couldn't really get the distribution. That's why they're income was down so low. Apple TV wants to get involved and into this. This is something to really follow. And that is going to be schools like Stanford in California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Arizona, Arizona State. These are the type of schools that are going to be involved in it. And you'll be able to press your button and get onto the Apple TV device, and you'll be able to watch sports.
And there's so many people that love college sports, and the excitement of those those players who are working and trying as hard as they can to get to the next level. I look forward to seeing what will happen with this deal.
Steve, we've got big news. Big, big news here in North Carolina.
Yeah?
Steve, did you watch Wrexham?
I have not. I am aware of Wrexham. That is the series. What streaming platform is that on?
It's on Hulu, Steve.
Okay.
So, you know, you've got Ted Lasso and Apple TV Plus. On Hulu, you've got Wrexham. That is the over in jolly old Great Britain, Steve.
Yes.
Ryan Reynolds, along with his buddy, have purchased a soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
And Wrexham is this town that kind of didn't have a very good soccer team. That was the team that was bought. Their idea is you follow this, documentary. They're going to take this franchise from the bottom tier all the way to the Premier League. Steve, we get a friendly here in Chapel Hill. They're going to play one of the big boys in Chelsea, one of the world's most storied soccer franchises. And it's going to take place on July 19th over at Keenan Stadium here in North Carolina.
Wow. So do you have your tickets already? Are you going to be in attendance for this?
I've sent my text out to some buddies. We're going to try to get a group to go, and we'll see. We'll see how this works out. This is actually going to be pretty exciting. Once again, we have Wrexham, this from the television show. Mm-hmm. You got Ryan Reynolds and McElhinney as the other person that's involved in it. And Chelsea, once again, one of the great big ones. And I'll give you a little fun trivia on Keenan Stadium. So Keenan Stadium, when it was originally built, was surrounded by pine trees. And when Keenan gifted the land to the University of North Carolina to build the stadium, he said the stadium cannot be higher than the trees. So when the trees grow, the stadium adds seating.
Interesting.
How about that?
That is very interesting that they have that in their charter of how they're going to do things and living with the nature and making that stadium a part of the planet. That's lovely. I love that.
You love it. So Steve, thinking about what the agreement was, and the trees, by the way, have grown.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think they got more seating?
I assume that they put in more seats. I don't know.
The question was, how did they accomplish getting more seating if the trees have grown?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they dug out the bowl.
That's fun. That is fun. They went the other way with it, literally.
So this is a lot of fun. It's something to look for. You may have some kind of friendly, that's when a soccer match is, played outside of a league and kind of for the joy of it.
Mm-hmm.
You get to go see two teams that normally would not play each other. Chelsea is in the Premier League. Wrexham still, I think they just won. I think they move up a level.
Okay.
But still, not anywhere near it. It's kind of like the King County Cougars, I don't know, playing the Chicago Cubs. You know, I'm sorry. Maybe something a little closer to a chance. Maybe they're playing the White Sox, right, Steve? right?
Wait, the White Sox are still a Chicago team? We always forget about the White Sox. That's great. There's so many fun things happening. Boy, it's the end of April. We're getting into May, getting into all sorts of shenanigans are going to happen in the next month, Chip.
A countdown for Steve till the end of school.
Yes, the countdown is on for sure. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we come back next week, Steve.
Yes, sir. We want to thank Pam Bedour for coming in for our monthly book club. We had so much silliness, so much fun. You could tell it was one of my books. We'll hear her book next month and really get into some good literature. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're still on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
We'll see you in the future.
Steve, the Dire Wolves, they work together in a pack.
like velociraptors at all.
Shields up. Perimeter scans to max.